Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
We're not always very good at valuing specific items. I'm not always very good at determining how much something is worth. And so if you watch a game show like The Price is Right, where you've got to guess the price, maybe of common everyday items, maybe of big ticket items, that's not really been a strength of mine. In fact, I think all of us at some level struggle with how to assign value to specific things in life. In 2007, a New York family made a find at a garage sale of a beautiful bowl that they paid $3 for and put on their mantle and thought it looked really good. Until a few years later, they had a visitor who remarked not just how good it looked, but it looked like it might be worth something. And so they decided to have it appraised. And when they went to the Sotheby's auction house, it was appraised for over $200,000. It was evidently a Chinese bowl made from the Northern Song Dynasty. It had been handed down, and it had been bought at yard sales and garage sales. It ended up in their house. In fact, a collector in London purchased it for more than $2 million. It was an incredible find that was sold at a yard sale. Now, you've probably heard stories like that before, about a painting or about a baseball card or something incredibly valuable that gets sold at a small price, and then all of a sudden you find out it's worth a lot more. And the question, of course, is always, well, why would that be sold for that small price at a garage sale, at a yard sale? Why would someone let it go if they knew they had something valuable? And the answer, of course, is they didn't know the value of what they had. They had something valuable, but didn't realize it. They didn't assign the right value to it, and because of that, they parted with it for just a few dollars. Sometimes it's hard for us to assign the right value to different elements of our life. We've been going through the Gospel of Mark, a series we're calling Deeper Discipleship, wanting to dig deep in our faith. And as we get to Mark chapter 12, we spent some time in the first part of the chapter last week, but we're drawing near the end of Jesus' public ministry. He's going to spend some time talking to his disciples and apostles in the next chapter, but as far as him teaching publicly in the temple area, this brings it to a close. And all through Mark chapter 12, we've seen the resistance as it's growing greater and really coming to a head in the crucifixion that's going to take place, the resistance of the religious leaders to what Jesus is doing. All of a sudden, Jesus is threatening the power structure that they had. They don't like what he's teaching, and so they start challenging him. They ask him difficult hypothetical questions that are trying to trap him into saying maybe he doesn't think you should pay taxes, or to get into the latest controversy they were dealing with on the resurrection. And you see that all through chapter 12. And in the midst of these questions, you see something that's kind of tucked away there by one of the scribes who gets the sense, Mark tells us, that Jesus is answering these questions wisely. And so he approaches Jesus in verse 28 and says, "Which commandment is the foremost of all?" Again, this is not a random question. This would have been something that rabbis discussed about the Jewish law. Which of the commands is the greatest? How is he going to answer this one? They're wanting him to weigh in on paying taxes. They're wanting him to weigh in on the resurrection of the dead and how that's going to work. Now they want him to weigh in on what the greatest command is. And he answers with something familiar, something that Jewish families would have known and would have recited. "The foremost is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." So we get a hint in the middle of these questions that Jesus is pointing to the two greatest commands, one from Deuteronomy, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. One we see in places like Leviticus, that you love your neighbor as yourself. These are old commands, but they're important ones. Jesus says that's how you sum up what really matters. But then we see those priorities contrasted with what Jesus says towards the end of this chapter. He's already said what the most important command is, what we need to have first in our lives, and then he's going to point out the ways in which they aren't living up to that standard. So we're going to spend a few moments this morning thinking about what it means to put first things first. What does it mean to have priorities in our lives that are aligned the way they should be? To assign the right value to every element of our life. That's a challenge sometimes. And depending on our circumstances, we might start valuing different elements of our lives differently. And so how do we sort this out? How do we work through it? Well, Graham did a great job reading for us what happens when Jesus sees a widow going to the temple treasury. So let's back up a few verses and see what leads up to this. We've already pointed out several times in Mark that the order of the way in which Mark records things seems to be making a point. We've seen kind of the sandwich effect where you've had something happens, then another story, and then it comes back around to that first thing and they go together. Well, in a similar way, we really understand what Jesus says about the widow when we back up to verse 38. In his teaching, he was saying, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and like respectful greetings in the marketplaces and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets, who devour widows' houses and for appearance's sake offer long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation." He speaks about scribes that were devouring widows' houses. And then in that context, Mark says, Jesus sat down, and as he started observing, many rich people were putting in large sums. But in verse 42, a poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which amount to a cent. Calling his disciples to him, he said to them, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all the contributors to the treasury. For they all put out of their surplus, but she out of her poverty put in all she owned, all she had to live on." So what does it mean to put first things first, according to Jesus? He's already told us what the greatest commandment is and what the second greatest commandment is, that we love God. If I love God with everything, then I'm going to love my neighbor as myself. So what does it mean to order my entire life around those priorities? Just think about that for a moment. What would it mean if we looked at all the priorities we have in our life and we ordered our lives around those two things? Think about someone whose values you've really appreciated in your life. Maybe it's a parent, grandparent, friend, family member. Someone you look at and you say they really have it together. They really have their values, their heart's in the right place. How did you discover that? Did they tell you, these are my priorities? Did they say, well, this is what really matters? Or could you see it in the way that they lived? Could you observe it? We don't have to tell people what our priorities are. People will find that out. I don't have to tell people what I value. They'll see that if they see me in the way that I'm living. So let's think about these individuals we're introduced to and then reflect on ourselves. First, Jesus talks about the scribes. What were the first things for the scribes? What was it that they were valuing above all else? Well, Jesus gets pretty specific in verse 38. He starts out by talking about their status. Status seemed to be very important for these scribes. They were well-educated, understanding the law. Sometimes a translation would say lawyer, and what that means is understanding the law of Moses. And so a scribe would often be distinguished from others. Jesus talks about their long robes. And from what historians tell us, they would often have long linen robes, kind of prayer robes, prayer shawl, that might reach all the way down to the feet. They might have a fringe on it and was likely white, kind of a signal as to belonging to a special class of people. This would have been in contrast with everyone around them. So there was something about what they wore in their robes that would set them apart. And scribes were treated with utmost respect. Their words were often viewed as possessing a certain kind of authority. They were the ones you wanted to go to. You have a question about the law, here are the people that you call. Here's someone you've got to talk to. And when they walked in the street, in a lot of cases, historians tell us people would rise to greet them. that they'd be respected. When they walked in, you stood up. You didn't greet them sitting down, and you used words like master or rabbi. When a feast was given, it was considered a thing of honor to have an influential scribe and his students at your dinner, to have them at the head of the table. In synagogues, they would have sat facing most of the congregation with their back to the chest that held the scroll of the Torah. So they had this sort of sense of being in front of everyone. They had the status of being a leader. Jesus says that's what they were valuing. They wanted people to look at them a certain way. They wanted to stand out. And in the places that they sat, they wanted to have that status. But he also says that money seemed to matter to scribes. It seems that they were often placed in charge of handling estates for people, sometimes for wealthy people. But the comment Jesus makes about devouring widows' houses, it may mean that they were mismanaging the funds and the estates of some widows. It may mean they were taking advantage of hospitality from widows who couldn't afford it. We don't know exactly what they were doing, but we do know how serious Jesus takes it. In fact, Jesus states at the end, I don't know if you caught that little phrase where he said in verse 40, these will receive greater condemnation. There are only a few instances in Scripture where we get this sense that the standard is going to be different for people in a specific role. So James, for example, would say, don't let many of you be teachers because they'll incur a stricter judgment. In other words, he's saying there's a higher standard if you're going to stand up and teach others. And it seems like these lawyers, these people who were supposed to be teachers of the law and were taking advantage of it, it's almost that same principle where Jesus is saying there's going to be a stricter judgment for those people who are taking advantage of this position and taking advantage of what others have. In fact, God has always been serious about taking care of people who can't care for themselves. This is something that's important for us to spend time thinking about. Because we see all the way back in the Psalms, in Psalm 68 and verse 5, look at the way God is described here. A father of the fatherless and a judge for the widow is God in his holy habitation. In the ancient world, those who didn't have parents and were orphaned, and those who were widows and didn't have a head of the household, a patriarch, to fight for them in a court of law, those would have been the easiest to take advantage of. And we're reminded that God is for those. In fact, Isaiah chapter 10 records a woe, a prophetic pronouncement against people who were enacting evil laws, who were doing things that were unjust. But notice what happens in verse 2. They were robbing the poor of my people of their rights so that widows may be their spoil and they may plunder the orphans. What was God worried about among his people? They were taking advantage of widows and orphans, those who didn't have the means to defend themselves. And so it's not a surprise that when we get to James chapter 1, James would describe pure and undefiled religion as this: visiting the orphans and widows in their distress and keeping oneself unstained by the world. God has always valued standing up for the defenseless. That's why one of the first challenges in the early church in the book of Acts comes when they're trying to take care of widows and make sure those who needed help had the help that they needed. That's why Paul would write to Timothy, and one of the instructions he gives them in 1 Timothy is, okay, here's how you're going to take care of those widows who are in need in your congregation. That has always been a value. But it seems like the scribes have been distracted by that because of a focus on money. Money seemed to matter. It was one of those first things that caused them to lose sight of what was important. And then appearance seems to be a priority for the scribes. When Jesus would preach the Sermon on the Mount, he would take issue with that same thing that the Pharisees were doing, and he would focus on specific religious actions, praying and fasting in front of others, and giving, trying to do things to be seen by men. And there's a phrase that comes up several times that I think is a haunting one if we focus on appearance. It says that when you give to the poor, when you do all of these things, truly I say to you, he said, those who give to the poor to be seen by others, they have their reward in full. Those who pray long prayers to be heard by others, they have their reward in full. Those who make themselves look miserable when they're fasting, so people will look at them and say, wow, they must be really spiritual because they're fasting. He says, you have your reward in full. Don't expect anything else to come. That's the fullness of what you can hope for. Because when we focus on appearances, it might be nice for people to notice those. It might be gratifying for people to see us a certain way. But that's going to be the extent of our reward. And so the scribes contrast with the first thing that we see here in the widow giving in the temple. The first thing for the widow, it seems to be devotion. Devotion to God. Devoting literally everything that she has to God. And so as we think about this, I'm always reminded of something I was given years ago by someone who had been to Israel. And I think I've shared these before. There are these coins that you can buy. And if you're wondering if they're legitimate, I have a certificate of authenticity right here. So that shows you how authentic they are. But they're coins you can buy that are widow's mite types. If nothing else, they give us a visual illustration of what these coins might have looked like. So you could probably barely even see these just from where I'm standing. And I have to tell you that I thought about taking a picture and putting it up on the screen, but you don't get much more detail even when you look close. These just aren't very noticeable things. And as translations will say, as we've read, they would add up to a penny or a cent. That's actually being relatively generous. That's the smallest unit of measurement of money that we can think of. It was a fraction of a day's wage that these two coins would add up to. In fact, think about it this way. If you're walking somewhere and you saw on the ground a $100 bill, what are the chances you would stop and pick it up? Saw a $100 bill, I'd probably pick it up. What if it was a little dirty, a little gross, it kind of been grimy and sitting on the floor for a while? $100 bill, we'd still probably pick it up. $50 bill? $20 bill? How low would it have to be for you to be willing to dig through some of the grime or some of the dirt to pick it up? What if you saw a penny on the floor and it was gross and it was kind of almost black because of the dirt in there and you passed by? Would it even be worth it to bend down and to pick that up and to pry it off if it was stuck to the floor? Chances are, you've seen coins like that or you've seen a situation like that and said, you know, I just don't think that's worth it. I don't want to have to deal with all the Purell and the sanitizing I would need after trying to pry that off the ground. The value just isn't enough. It seems like the two coins that the widow was holding would have been in that category that might not even have been worth bending down to pick up, and that's what she is taking to the treasury. Now, the temple complex, as we've talked about, was very large, and there were treasury boxes evidently in what was called the court of women that men and women could both enter into. And there were different kinds of offerings that had to be made to the temple. There was the temple tax, which we've talked about already, but there were also various free will offerings that you could make. And some of the sources of Jewish teachings over the years have kind of specified what different categories of free will offerings those would have been. And keep in mind, this is nearing the time of the Passover when people from all over were coming to the temple. The temple would have been very busy. And so it seems that this widow, who should have been taken care of by others, was coming to a place where people are making these huge donations, and she drops in these two coins, these lepta, as they're called, that would equal a fraction of a day's wage. Probably not enough to bend up and pick up off the ground. And yet what she does catches Jesus' attention. Now, it's powerful to me that she does this without even knowing that Jesus is watching. I don't know if you've thought about that before, but she doesn't know that there's any audience for what's taking place. I would imagine there were some people who, when they came into the temple and they gave, they knew people were watching. They might have even acted a certain way because they thought, people are going to see what I'm giving. They're going to hear how it sounds when I drop it in this receptacle and hear this loud noise of all of these coins. Those two little slivers of coin that the woman dropped wouldn't have amounted to much, wouldn't have made much noise. But Jesus is watching. We tend to act differently when we think people are watching. I can remember being in kindergarten, and my kindergarten teacher had a habit that she would have every day of planting seeds for whoever was going to be the helper for the next day. And she would say that she'd be watching us, and if we were being good, and if we were helping, and if we were lining up the way that we should, and if we were obeying instructions, at some point about lunchtime, she would say, "Don't let that gleam leave your eye." And that was the code word. We all knew what that meant. That meant we were on the right track. That if we kept behaving all day, the next day, we'd get to be the helper. And that, of course, meant getting to be the line leader. And is there anything more important when you're that age than getting to be the line leader? We knew that was coming. I can still remember when you would get that, when she would say, "I've got my eye on you. Don't let that gleam leave your eye." That means the whole rest of the day, I was thinking, what can I do? You know, how can I be good? How can I make sure that I get this? Because I knew she was watching. We tend to act differently when people are watching. But Jesus is viewing this woman that no one seems to be watching. And she gives everything. I think if we're trying to imagine, again, we don't get all the details here. If we're trying to imagine what happened, it seems to me that maybe since it's around Passover, maybe this is a special time she comes to the temple and this is all that she has, and she puts that in the treasury, this offering. All she can do, maybe there are things she wishes she could do, but she just can't. She just gives what she has. But in this action, she does exactly what the rich young ruler wasn't able to do when we read about him a few weeks ago. Remember, Jesus asked him to give everything he had. And he went away sad because he had a great many possessions. So is it any wonder that Jesus would tell the apostles, you know, it's hard for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven? Doesn't say it's impossible for people who have a lot to enter the kingdom of heaven. He just says the more we have, the harder it will be for us to be willing to let go. She is doing exactly what the rich young ruler struggled and eventually walked away from God to do. And we might look at that and say, well, you have to cut him some slack. I mean, he has a lot and she doesn't have very much. But giving all you have isn't dependent on how much that amount is. Right? If we give all we have, whether it's a lot or a little, if it's all we have, that's all we have to offer. And so I think the power and the challenge of this passage is kind of a double-edged sword. The power is it's good news that I don't have to be wealthy to be generous. I can give what I have, and no matter how much or how little it is, if I give it to God, then I'm devoting myself to Him. That's a powerful thing, but it's a challenge because the challenge is it requires a sacrifice that puts God above everything else. And if it's a situation where I have a lot to give and a lot to hold on to, that's going to be a lot to sacrifice. I think about the way Paul wrote to the church in Corinth and described how the Christians in Macedonia were giving, and he said, in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty. Doesn't that sound like this widow at the temple? Their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. Well, how can they be in poverty and have some kind of wealth at the same time? Paul says the wealth was in their giving. You don't have to be wealthy to be generous. You can be in poverty and still have a wealth overflowing of generosity. So the contrast is so sharp here that Jesus is pointing out. Here were these scribes who were so focused on status and money and appearance, and here's someone who didn't have that. You couldn't find someone of a lower status than this widow in the temple. She obviously didn't have very much money. The appearance, I would imagine, would not have even compared to the way scribes would carry themselves. And yet, she gives in this incredible way. So what does that mean for us? Maybe it's worthwhile for us to take a few minutes right now and just ask ourselves, what are the first things in our lives? The first things for us. What have I valued? Because it's easy to imagine that scribes shouldn't have gotten so caught up in the robes that they wore, and they shouldn't have gotten so consumed in how people saw them at feast. But what are our translations today of those temptations. When are we tempted to put our status first? You know, we live in a world that seems to be becoming increasingly self-centered, right? It's increasingly easy for us to think about ourselves instead of other people on all kinds of different levels. When is it easy for me to put myself first? My own status, where I stand, how people perceive me, how I want to be seen. And when this is our value, we become fixated on the way our position relates to others. And so I want to figure out, okay, am I in a better position than this person or not? Everyone I meet, that's what I'm thinking. Where do I stack up with this person? Is that my first priority? If that's my first priority, life's going to be pretty frustrating. And the example of giving money is always a challenge for us, especially for those of us that live in the time that we do and in the country that we do and have blessings that others in the world could only dream about. It's a challenge to think about those things. I found it interesting. There's a quote that's attributed to Ray Kroc from over the years. Ray Kroc is often thought of as the founder of McDonald's. He didn't open the first restaurant, but he did kind of become the founder of McDonald's itself. And when he was asked by a reporter one time about his priorities, he said this is what he believed in this order. He said, I believe in God and in family and then in McDonald's, in that order. But then he said something interesting. He said, when I get to work, I reverse the order. So I believe in God, family, and work. That sounds pretty good. But when I get to work, I reverse it. Now, that might be the recipe for excelling at a job, but it's not consistent with what we read about here. Our goal is to never reverse that order, to always keep that God, family, then work, then others. I mean, that is the kind of priority list that we see reflected when Jesus speaks about the greatest commands. I'll never forget a conversation I had over 10 years ago now with someone who's my age, who was describing how hard his father had worked growing up. And his father had a good job and a good business, but he kept working. He worked extra hours. He did all of these things because his goal was to give his children the best they could possibly have, the best house and property, with everything on the house and property that you can imagine, but that just resulted in him always being away. He didn't spend a lot of time with his son growing up. And as I talked with his son, now an adult, he said, you know, I appreciate the fact that Dad wanted to give us all those things, but all I really wanted was my dad. Now, the reason I remember that is because that was shortly after Luke was born, and I was thinking in terms of a father and trying to glean from that conversation that the priorities that I should have, but it's always stuck with me. We often think what people want from us is what we can give them, when maybe our presence, our investment in their life is what really matters. If money's my first thing, then that's not going to follow. Or maybe appearances are my first things. We might kind of smile at scribes caring about where they sat, but have I ever cared about something that doesn't really matter in the long run? Have I ever gotten overly concerned about something that doesn't really have all that much significance? This is one of the temptations for using, or rather misusing, money, because we want to keep up certain appearances. And so we want to drive the right vehicle and live in the right neighborhood and go on the right vacations and have people look at us and see us a specific way. There are so many times when it matters to us how people see us. And yet, Jesus causes us to ask the question, is that really the first thing? Or when it comes to the first things for us, is my first priority devotion to God? You see, I don't have to tell people what my priorities are. They'll see that. I don't have to tell people what my values are. They'll notice that. And so it's interesting even to reflect on the people that know us best, our friends, our family, our children. They know what matters to us. If I value something, I won't have to tell my children I value it. They'll see it. If I care about something, I don't have to tell my friends I care about it. They'll know. So, for example, if I value worship, if I value being with brothers and sisters in Christ, and I prioritize that in my life, I won't have to tell my family it's important. They'll see it. If I don't value that, I won't have to tell them it's unimportant. They'll just see that too. They'll see what my values are. If I value caring for others and giving to others, people who are around me will see that. They'll know that. If I don't, if I value myself above all else, people will figure that out too. They figure that out pretty quickly. If I value spending time in God's Word, people that I love will know this. People that are around me will see this. But if I value spending time on only doing what I want to do, people will pick up on that too. If I value what God thinks about me, if that's my number one priority is to serve Him, everyone around me is going to figure that out very quickly. But if I'm consumed with what others think about me, it's not going to take long for those around me to pick up on that. What's my first priority? What first things are ordering my life? And if I need to readjust that, if I need to reflect on this small gift and the contrast it made with the actions of the scribes that Jesus is pointing out, at the end of his public teaching in Mark, this is what Jesus dwells on. When he thinks about the greatest commands of giving God everything, of worshiping him with all that we have, what are my first things? You know, one of the really valuable parts of this passage I've been reflecting on this week is that we don't really have a record in the text of the woman herself understanding the significance of this gift. I have to imagine that she knew the value of what she had and that it wasn't much monetary value. Jesus talks to his disciples about her, but we don't read about him approaching her and talking about this gift. But think about how many people over the years, centuries, have been encouraged because of what they've read here. This woman's gift, in its importance and value, dwarfs, in comparison, it dwarfs the gifts of others that were around there. It's so their gifts might have been so great and so incredible, but it's minuscule in comparison to what this woman gave. It's encouraging to me because this morning it may feel like you don't have a lot to give. And I don't mean monetarily. I mean in whatever ways we serve God. You might feel like what you have isn't much. It's not worth much. It's not going to accomplish much. But it could be that as we give what we have in ways that are behind the scenes, in ways that other people might not notice right now, it could be that what you're giving can make an impact you would never imagine. I cannot imagine this widow could have anticipated what this gift would have done and the impact it would have made. You could be doing something right now for God that might impact the world in a way that you can't imagine, impact your community, impact your family in a way that you don't even understand right now. Isn't that powerful to think about what God can do with what we give? So let's just ask ourselves this morning, what's the first thing in my life? It may be that you need to readjust some priorities and make God the first thing in your life. If you need to put Christ on in baptism, that's what that action of submission does. We're dying to ourselves, and we're being raised up to walk in a new life where God is first. It may be that you need to readjust priorities and ask for prayers. After this worship service, if you go through this doorway, there'll be a conference room with a couple of our elders who'd love to sit down and to pray with you and for you. But it may be that you want the prayers of this congregation. If there's any way that we can help you, let's reflect on how we can put God first, put first things first in the way that we live. If we can help you, please let us know as we stand and as we all sing together.